Chapter 11. It is not only in Napoleonic memoirs that the French are so fortunate. The almost equally interesting age of Louis XIV produced an even more wonderful series. If you go deeply into the subject, you are amazed by their number, and you feel as if everyone at the court of the Roi Soleil had done what he or she could to give away their neighbors. Just to take the more obvious, there are Saint Simon's memoirs. Those in themselves give us a more comprehensive and intimate view of the age than anything I know of, which treats of the times of Queen Victoria. Then there is Saint Evremond, who is nearly as complete. Do you want the view of a woman of quality? There are the letters of Madame de Sévigné, 8 volumes of them, perhaps the most wonderful series of letters that any woman has ever penned. Do you want the confessions of a rake of the period? Here are the two salacious memoirs of the mischievous Duc de Roquelaure, not reading for the nursery certainly, not even for the boudoir, but a strange and very intimate picture of the times. All these books fit into each other, for the characters of the one reappear in the others. You come to know them quite familiarly before you have finished, their loves and their hates, their duels, their intrigues, and their ultimate fortunes. If you do not care to go so deeply into it, you have only to put Julia Pardo's four-volumed Court of Louis XIV upon your shelf, and you will find a very admirable condensation, or a distillation rather, for most of the salt is left behind. There is another book too, that big one on the bottom shelf, which holds it all between its brown and gold covers. An extravagance that, for it cost me some sovereigns, but it is something to have the portraits of all that wonderful galaxy, of Louis, of the devout Maintenon, of the frail Montespan, of Bossuet, Fenelon, Molière, Racine, Pascal, Conde, Turin, and all the saints and sinners of the age. If you want to make yourself a present, and chance upon a copy of The Court and Times of Louis XIV, you will never think that your money has been wasted. Well, I have bored you unduly, my patient friend, with my love of memoirs, Napoleonic and otherwise, which give a touch of human interest to the arid records of history. Not that history should be arid. It ought to be the most interesting subject upon earth, the story of ourselves, of our forefathers, of the human race, the events which made us what we are, and wherein, if Wiseman's views hold the field, some microscopic fraction of this very body which for the instant we chance to inhabit may have borne a part. But unfortunately the power of accumulating knowledge and that of imparting it are two very different things, and the uninspired historian becomes merely the dignified compiler of an enlarged almanac. Worst of all, when a man does come along with fancy and imagination, who can breathe the breath of life into the dry bones, it is the fashion for the dryasdists to belabor him, as one who has wandered away from the orthodox path, and must necessarily be inaccurate. So Froude was attacked. So also Macaulay in his day. But both will be read when the pedants are forgotten. If I were asked my very ideal of how history should be written, I think I should point to those two rows on yonder shelf, the one Garthie's History of Our Own Times, the other Lecky's History of England in the 18th century. Curious that each should have been written by an Irishman, and that though of opposite politics and living in an age when Irish affairs have caused such bitterness, both should be conspicuous not merely for all literary graces, but for that broad toleration which sees every side of a question, and handles every problem from the point of view of the philosophic observer, and never of the sectarian partisan. By the way, talking of history, have you read Parkman's works? He was, I think, among the very greatest of the historians, and yet one seldom hears his name. A New England man by birth, and writing principally of the early history of the American settlements, and of French Canada, it is perhaps excusable that he should have no great vogue in England, but even among Americans I have found many who have not read him. There are four of his volumes in green and gold down yonder, The Jesuits in Canada, and Frontenac, but there are others, all of them well worth reading, Pioneers of France, Montcalm, and Wolfe, Discovery of the Great West, etc. Someday I hope to have a complete set. Taking only that one book, the Jesuits in Canada, it is worth a reputation in itself. And how noble a tribute is this which a man of Puritan blood pays to that wonderful order. He shows how in the heyday of their enthusiasm these brave soldiers of the cross invaded Canada as they did China and every other place, where danger was to be faced, and a horrible death to be found. I don't care what faith a man may profess, or whether he be a Christian at all, but he cannot read these true records without feeling that the very highest that man has ever evolved in sanctity and devotion was to be found among these marvelous men. They were indeed the pioneers of civilization, for apart from doctrines they brought among the savages the highest European culture, and in their own deportment an object lesson of how chastely, austerely, and nobly men could live. France has sent myriads of brave men onto her battlefields, but in all her long record of glory I do not think that she can point to any courage so steadfast and so absolutely heroic as that of the men of the Iroquois mission. How nobly they lived makes the body of the book, how serenely they died forms the end to it. It is a tale which cannot even now be read without a shudder, a nightmare of horrors. Fanaticism may brace a man to hurl himself into oblivion, as the Mahdi's hordes did before Khartoum, but one feels that it is at least a higher development of such emotion, where men slowly and in cold blood endure so thankless a life, and welcome so dreadful an end. Every faith can equally boast its martyrs, a painful thought, since it shows how many thousands must have given their blood for error, but in testifying to their faith these brave men have testified to something more important still, to the subjugation of the body, and to the absolute supremacy of the dominating spirit. The story of Father Jogues is but one of many, and yet it is worth recounting, as showing the spirit of the men. He also was on the Iroquois mission, and was so tortured and mutilated by his sweet parishioners, that the very dogs used to howl at his distorted figure. He made his way back to France, not for any reason of personal rest or recuperation, but because he needed a special dispensation to say Mass. The Catholic Church has a regulation that a priest shall not be deformed, so that the savages with their knives had wrought better than they knew. He received his dispensation, and was sent for by Louis XIV, who asked him what he could do for him. No doubt the assembled courtiers expected to hear him ask for the next vacant bishopric. What he did actually ask for, as the highest favor, was to be sent back to the Iroquois mission, where the savages signalized his arrival by burning him alive. Parkman is worth reading, if it were only for his account of the Indians. Perhaps the very strangest thing about them, and the most unaccountable, is their small numbers. The Iroquois were one of the most formidable of tribes. They were of the five nations, whose scalping parties wandered over an expanse of thousands of square miles. Yet there is good reason to doubt whether the whole five nations could have put as many thousand warriors in the field. It was the same with all the other tribes of Northern Americans, both in the East, the North, and the West. Their numbers were always insignificant. And yet they had that huge country to themselves, the best of climates, and plenty of food. Why was it that they did not people it thickly? It may be taken as a striking example of the purpose and design which run through the affairs of men, that at the very moment when the old world was ready to overflow, the new world was empty to receive it. Had North America been peopled as China is peopled, the Europeans might have founded some settlements, but could never have taken possession of the continent. Buffon has made the striking remark that the creative power appeared to have never had great vigor in America. He alluded to the abundance of the flora and fauna as compared with that of other great divisions of the Earth's surface. Whether the numbers of the Indians are an illustration of the same fact, or whether there is some special cause, is beyond my very modest scientific attainments. When one reflects upon the countless herds of bison which used to cover the western plains, or marks in the present day the race statistics of the French Canadians at one end of the continent, and of the southern Negro at the other, it seems absurd to suppose that there is any geographical reason against nature being as prolific here as elsewhere. However, these be deeper waters, and with your leave we will get back into my usual 6-inch wading depth once more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.